Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today, on episode 195, we are covering the October 2019 issue of Retinal Physician. As a reminder, Retinal Physician is published in print and is available online at retinalphysician.com. For this issue, Dr. Ajay Kurian joins me and we tackle a couple of articles reviewing them, including some complications of silicone oil, using anterior segment maneuvers as a retinal surgeon, MIGS and understanding these new glaucoma devices for retina specialists, and an overview of anti-VEGF and PDR written by Dr. Jennifer Lin. Remember that a list of financial disclosures for this episode can be found in the episode description, and you will be able to claim CME credits for this episode and others by clicking on the link in the episode description. That will take you to the American Academy of Ophthalmology website where you can claim your CME. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now happy to be joined by podcast MVP, retina specialist extraordinaire, surgeon non-par excellence, or whatever that, I don't know. I'm not eloquent enough to say that properly. Dr. Ajay Kurian, University of Rochester. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me back again, Jay.
I'm keeping Ajay up super late. You don't know want to know when we're recording this. So I'm going to be the caffeinated one here, and I'm going to be energetic. And what we're going to do today is we are going to go through some of the articles from the October 2019 issue of Retinal Physician. As always, these articles are available at retinalphysician.com. Again, we are not here to do a complete summary or journal club of these articles. These articles are peer-reviewed often, but these are more summary-type articles. We're using them as jumping points for discussion. So the first article we're going to talk about is called Complications After Removal of Silicone Oil by one of our awesome and stellar third-year residents, Diana Laura, here at Bascom Palmer, with Dr. Yale Fisher, Dr. Bill Smitty, and Dr. Harry Flynn as co-authors. And I'll just briefly go through, you know, they talk about reasons you might need to use oil and all the possible things that can go wrong from using silicone oil. So Ajay, you know, I'll be very frank, I think there's definitely scenarios. I'm very glad we have oil. There's certain scenarios I use oil, and oil is definitely something that you need to have in your armamentarium, especially if you're dealing with complex cases. You know, which of these things do you think gets least talked about when we talk about problems with oil?
I think one of the least talked about things is the sudden loss of vision that happens sometimes after silicone oil removal. I think it's in the back of people's heads, but it's not something that I usually expect to happen after silicone oil removal.
And I wonder, you know, again, we only use oil in certain scenarios, right? You know, I think that obviously monocular status can play a role for functional reasons. But, you know, they list all the indications you may use oil. All of these have the similar sort of risk factor, which is there's a high risk of recurrent detachment, whether it's PVR, giant retinal tears, severe PDR, viral retinitis, trauma, and the like. These are high risk for recurrent detachment. Even though oil doesn't decrease the risk of recurrent detachment, it offers a little more support than gas and may temporize the detachment that recurs. I agree. I think that sometimes maybe we don't talk about this because we don't know why it happens, and we don't know how to prevent it necessarily. You know, there was a series I know done that was published in Ophthalmology showing that leaving oil past 3 months, maybe to 6 months, may cause more of an issue with kind of vision loss, maybe due to damage of either the Müller cells or the nerve fiber layer. What can you tell patients when you take oil? I mean, I always talk to them that the vision may not improve to the degree you expect, but I think we've all seen patients who refract to a certain level and then you take oil out and this is not to the level you would have expected.
Yeah, after I had one patient who experienced this, now I basically tell every patient that very, very rarely there's cases of the vision getting worse after the oil coming out. I haven't had one since that initial case that I've had, but it's definitely a very frustrating thing to experience where a patient was seeing better with pinhole with the oil in, and then you're expecting them to see at that level once the oil comes out and they're refracted properly, and they just never obtain that vision.
You know, one thing that's motivated me to do, I do have patients who don't live in Miami or travel here for travel reasons who get oil. It's motivated me to be a little more, when I use oil for travel reasons, and I try to avoid that, but if we have to do it, I do it. I'm just a little more aggressive in terms of maybe getting it out early. And I know there's not much evidence about the time factor, but I do think that maybe getting it out right at that 3-month point is good, assuming that there's no PVR or something like brewing under the oil. Obviously, every case is different, but do you follow a similar, like, do you, I used to be like, you know, if you get it out 3 months, 4 months, 5 months, it's okay. It's like, there's no rush. But now I really kind of emphasize that maybe it's better to take it out early, assuming there's not another indication to leave it in.
Yeah, I think especially when it's done for a convenience standpoint, like you just mentioned, I think the drive towards keeping it in longer is less prevalent. And so certainly if there's a potential for other problems to occur after the oil stays in, I think it's prudent to take it out at a reasonable time period within the 3 months. But when you're looking at certain cases with PVR and recurrent detachments, it's nice to feel like you could have that oil in for a little longer to see if PVR membranes mature during that time period. And so I think that's where the balance is when you're oil for that oil in for longer than 3 months. But I think we've been able to study this in a fashion that provides us really good data to show the optimal time period to have the oil to find that balance between the potential for problems and ensuring that the primary purpose of the oil is carried out, like reattaching the retina.
Well, speeding right along, Jennifer Lim from the University of Illinois, Chicago, wrote a wonderful article called Laser Therapy versus Anti-VEGF for Diabetic Retinopathy, with the subtitle Patient Compliance is a Key Factor in Treatment Choice. And briefly, again, to summarize, she kind of goes through things we've talked about before, pros and cons of laser anti-VEGF for treatment. Do you use anti-VEGF in a patient with a cerebrovascular cardiac event? How you manage macular edema? And, you know, goes into protocol V, patients with good visual acuity, and, you know, turns the side benefits of reduction in diabetic retinopathy severity, maybe patients who may still benefit from focal laser, and then protocol S data and clarity data talking about PRP, anti-VEGF for PDR, and a brief discussion of crunch and whether it's real or not. You know, we've talked about a lot of these topics before, so we're not going to beat a dead horse, but it's important, which is why we talk about it. You know, let's talk about crunch a little bit, Ajay. Crunch is something that people have talked about, but none of the studies really seem to demonstrate it. However, as she mentioned, DRCR and Clarity studies didn't really have the patients who would maybe be most prone to crunch included. Is crunch real? And if so...
My
second question, because this is a question I get a lot, and I had as a resident, and now resident fellows ask me all the time, which patients are highest risk for crunch?
Yeah, so I think she definitely made a great point about how the patients that were most worried about crunch weren't included in the studies. And so I think we don't have really good data because those patients are just not included in clinical trials because they're usually excluded based on the inclusion-exclusion criteria. That being said, I'm sure all of us have had patients who have crunched. And so I think the question of whether crunch is real, I think we've all experienced it. Now, whether that's crunch is different with an anti-VEGF versus PRP, it's because we've also seen a fair share of patients who crunch after PRP as well. I think it's hard to know exactly who's going to be at higher risk for crunch, because there's certainly times where you do a pre-op Avastin and you don't really see many changes within that window of surgery, and including in patients who for some reason are delayed and have a longer time period after that initial pre-op Avastin than what you would like them to, and you still don't see that they progressed and got worse. But that being said, there is a subset of patients that do significantly develop more traction and potentially worsening of their macular status after an anti-VEGF or laser.
Right. I mean, I think the important distinction, I guess people argue this is something that there's no consensus on. I think there are people who are very smart to argue it's not a real thing. The people who are very smart who said it is a real thing. I'm going to postulate it is real, having seen it. I think there's a big difference between progressing traction and actual ripping of a retina, which turns into a combined pigmentogenous tractional detachment, which can happen simply from progression of traction too, in the absence of, you know, in the absence of any sort of treatment like laser or anti-VEGF. You know, I was always taught, and I think this was a really good point, you talked about patients being high risk. I think that the morphology of the NVE makes a difference, and then how much prior treatment they've had can make a difference as well. I think it's possible to crunch in any scenario, but if there's full laser and you're just talking about injecting, there's a small fibrovascular tuft, that is less likely in my mind to crunch, because it's not like you're bringing, it's not such a reduction in the anti-VEGF drive. And then the people argue the laser strengthens the retina. I think that's debatable, because I think surgically that sometimes that retina can actually be thinner and more prone to ripping depending on the scenario. I think the second thing is that I was taught, which is a really good pearl, was that for crunch to happen, you really, the most dangerous is when the NVE is more parallel to the retinal surface than vertical. Because as it progresses and contracts, it's more likely to cause a flap type tear type situation or a break versus if it's vertical. And that's a complete subjective thing. I don't think we have quantification of that in OCT or imaging. But these are kind of old school pearls from attendings that I thought were relatively helpful. Again, crunch is so rare, it's just hard to know. But I do think the opposite happens, where sometimes residents are hesitant or fellows are hesitant to treat a patient because they're so worried about crunch. And then sometimes I have to be like, look, like, yeah, the way he's weighing risks and benefits for this patient, this is not the highest risk for crunch. You know, you should go ahead and treat them with anti-VEGF versus just monotherapy with PRP.
Yeah, I think those are great pearls. It's a tough scenario. I think that as long as you're speaking to the patients about that potential for that worsening before providing that anti-VEGF, and let them know that it is possible that they'll progress to the point where they will have a decrease in vision and might need to progress to surgery, while putting it in the context that could still happen without, if we didn't do the injection, so the way they're aware of that risk, but also in the context of the natural history of really severe PDR with TRDs and tractional membranes. I think it makes sense to do the injections in some cases and see how it does.
Well, our next article features notorious former podcast correspondent and current NYU attending Dr. Yasha Modi, senior author in this article, An Introduction to MIGS for the Retina Specialists, subtitled Considerations for Managing Patients with New Glaucoma Devices and Surgeries. Mike Greenwood is the senior author on this paper, also Jonathan Myers and Mark Barakat. This was kind of a roundtable discussion of MIGS and what it is and, you know, what are the implications for retina specialists. You know, Ajay, any sort of things you've seen with MIGS? You know, one of the things they talk about has been cleft formation. They talk about, you know, issues with devices that can actually move around in the eye. I have not thankfully encountered that. And, you know, stents and hypotony maculopathy, which are normal considerations of glaucoma surgery. Have you seen any of these complications?
Yeah, I think I've certainly seen some patients who've developed hypotony, even though that's supposed to be less common than with some of the more traditional glaucoma surgeries. But most of the time they have the choroidals that are associated with it have resolved, or the hypotony maculopathy resolves on its own. There has been one patient that I helped take care of where during the placement of one of these MIGS procedures, the patient just moved very suddenly at a moment where the iris was also hooked, and it resulted in complete aniridia in that patient. And so one of my glaucoma specialists that I worked with points out that even though it's minimally invasive, it doesn't mean it's free of complications. And as one of the authors in this roundtable discussion points out, you learn about new complications that could be created with these. And so I think that it's great that there's these new options for glaucoma surgery, but certainly it has its own bag of potential problems that can happen.
You know, I can't believe you saw that. There are black clouds, and then there is Dr. Ajay Kurian. I mean, that's pretty extreme. You know, I think that that was probably, you mentioned the biggest take-home point of any of these devices is we don't know about complications until we start doing them and seeing what happens over time. You know, I've seen a couple of patients with CME, and it's hard to know if it's from the MIGS or it's from the, you know, they weren't done in the setting of cataract surgery, is it from the MIGS, is it from something else? But I do think CME, you know, anything can really cause CME in any place of the eye, I feel, through some degree of chronic inflammation. But this is a great review just to get familiar with these devices because, you know, medicine moves fast, and even within our field, other subspecialties are advancing, and, you know, we got to keep track of that. And it's kind of transitioning, Dr. Ali Khan, again, correspondent in the program, and my former co-fellow attending right now at rejoining Wills Eye Hospital, actually. He's wrote this article called Tips for Anterior Segment Manipulation with the subtitle Attention to Detail Can Maximize Surgical Outcomes, which is critical, I think, for surgical specialists because we're doing so many anterior segment type procedures like secondary IOLs and other procedures. He mentions multiple pearls, which viscoelastics to use in various situations, using it for corneal protection, how to dilate the pupil with hooks and breaking up adhesions, dealing with the bad iris, wound incisions, different wound constructions, you know, so many different things he goes through. A really, really, really helpful article. Ajay, you read this. What's the number one thing you read? And you're like, you know, if I was a fellow, I wish I had known X.
One of the things that I noted at some point during training was the removal of the Sommering ring through and blocked through the anterior chamber, which Ali points out. That can really take a long time sometimes to remove with the cutter. It's very nice to be able to just remove the entire thing through the wound and usually have a big enough wound to be able to take that out. And so I think that's a really big one. I think a lot of the stuff that Ali goes over in this is stuff that especially when you're just in fellowship after doing a lot of cataracts, it's easy to keep all these things in mind, but depending on how many anterior segment surgeries you're doing, either in combination with vitrectomy or not, it's great to have a good review of all the things that Ali talks about during this article.
Yeah, you know, I think the two biggest things is don't be afraid to put hooks in because visualization is so critical for getting a Sommering ring, for centering an IOL, and it just makes it takes like, once you get past it, it takes a minute, and it really, really can make a difficult case easy. And I think when I was even a resident, I had some sort of unconscious resistance to doing it, maybe from lack of familiarity, maybe just think it would take a long time. It's just something that if you're thinking about it, you should just do it. And I think the second thing is really knowing how to make a good tunnel is helpful. Because I think scleral tunnels are worth their weight in gold when they're made well, and they can be really nice, and they're easy to seal, and it makes it a lot easier to take out IOLs that sometimes are difficult to cut and maybe more traumatic to cut in the eye, or impossible to cut if they're made of PMMA.
Yeah, those are great points. It's the visualization is always key, and certainly those iris hooks can help out a lot. And a bad scleral tunnel is definitely something that is true. Have problems with throughout the rest of the case.
Yeah. That is true. I remember as a fellow, you know, you do tunnels and you get better. I remember one of the tunnels I made was really shallow, and the attending was just watching me and was just like, that is a really bad scleral tunnel. And I was like, thank you. That's true. It was right. It was a bad tunnel. It was too shallow and it didn't hold. And that's like much, much worse than a corneal wound. And so, yes, I agree. If it's not done well, it is worse than a corneal wound in a lot of ways. But if you can get comfortable with it, it definitely helps in terms of reducing astigmatism and protecting the cornea and making it really, really nice in terms of, it's definitely an art form. And knowing how to use a crescent blade is really critical and nice as I think that if you didn't do a lot of flaps or traps as a resident, we don't do that many scleral wounds anymore because we're doing so many clear corneal incisions. But it's definitely a helpful thing to practice on a globe or practice on a pig eye or something to get comfortable making tunnels and flaps.
Yeah, I think especially with a decreased reliance on AC IOLs with some of the new secondary IOL techniques, it's actually more and more rare that you do a scleral tunnel. I think most of my scleral tunnels are usually for explanting PMMA lenses or other lenses, like you said, that are very difficult to cut out or just not possible to cut out.
I think, and we've talked about this before, I think there's still a role for ACI IOLs. I think that a one-size-fits-all approach to IOLs is never going to be correct unless we get a perfect hydrophobic four-point fixation IOL or an iris claw lens that has no problems, which we'll wait and see. But Ajay, you stayed up super late. You didn't fall asleep. You made it. I'm excited that you're almost adapted for West Coast time at Academy. You're ready. I'll let you go in one sec. Knicks preseason.
Thanks a lot for having me, Jay.
Going great?
They're 1-0. We're going to win the title this year.
Who do they beat? I know who they beat. I just want you to say it out loud.
The Washington Wizards.
Yeah, man, it's okay. It's not going to happen. Did they win today? They won tonight. Oh, good. Very nice. Finally, I'm just going to say this because we're a firm believer in free speech here. The fact that Daryl Morey is potentially in trouble at risk of losing his job for a tweet supporting protesters in Hong Kong is simultaneously practical because the NBA makes so much money off of China, and crazy given free speech and the fact that actually it wasn't that inflammatory tweet. But I'm just going to leave that there. You don't have to do anything with it. I'm going to leave that there.
Yeah, it's definitely crazy, and I guess I was not expecting this degree of uproar from that initial tweet.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Kurian, thank you for your time. Thank you for staying up late. Get some sleep. I'll see you later this week.
Thanks for having me, Jay. Take care.
Take care, man. As always, this episode and all other episodes can be found online at our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. As of this episode, we have 195 episodes. It's 195 episodes available online. They're sorted by category. We have our blog as well with some great write-ups concerning our episodes and other topics. It's application season. We've got articles we've written in the past about applying for residency, applying for fellowship, how to interview well, travel tips. These are super critical and really timeless, at least for the next couple of years. Remember, you can contact us directly by tweeting at us. We're on Twitter at RetinaPodcast. You can email me directly at retinapodcast@gmail.com, or clicking on the contact us link on our website will also send an email to me. We have a Facebook page, and you can find us in the Apple Podcasts and Android store on your mobile device. We love getting feedback on things we can do better and things we're already doing well. We've got a couple of ideas now with AAO coming up and going on now, and we're going to roll out an expansion of some of the ideas we have. We appreciate anyone who subscribes via the Apple Store, Android Store, who listens and leaves positive reviews. It's very, very helpful, and we thank you for doing that. Many thanks to Dr. Ajay Kurian for joining me. Thanks to Jen Ford and the team at Pentavision for providing the articles from Retinal Physician. Thanks to Dr. Louis Kai, Dr. Angela Chang, and Dr. Michael Venicasa for preparing this episode. Listeners, thank you for what you do on a daily basis, the patient care you provide, the articles you read and publish, and the conversation to inspire. Hopefully you're listening to this either at the American Academy of Ophthalmology meeting or on your way home. Hope it was a fruitful meeting, and looking forward to seeing a lot of you recording this the night before we fly in. So hope that I can have a chance to see many of you there. It's a great opportunity for collaboration in San Francisco. This is Jay Schreeder signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.